jumped in the Land Rover. Three of them had to sit in the very back, but I'm sure they didn't mind. We sped off toward I-10 and then back toward the hotel. Every Marine in the vehicle sincerely thanked each of us for their lives. While driving back, I asked John to check them with the Geiger to see if they were fine. The meter indicated that they were giving off some ambient radiation from the mass of the dead, but it was insignificant. We really had no way to tell how much they had absorbed without their wearing dosimeters. We could only measure how many rads they were now giving off. Just before reaching the point where we had had to pull the car wreckage out of the way, I stopped the vehicle. I looked back and asked who was in charge. The Lance Corporal sounded off that he was in command of the others. I commented that he was a pretty low rank to be in charge on a remote reconnaissance mission like this. He was coy in his remark. "Wait until you meet our commanding officer." One of the others elbowed him to shut up. This was the moment I picked to lay down the law. I stated, "Lance Corporal, I can take you to a safe place with water, food, and a place to sleep, but you have to follow my rules. You will not be prisoners, and you can leave when you want." I could see him nod in the rear view in acknowledgement that he was ready to listen. I said, "You are going to have to surrender your firearms and submit to wearing a hood over your head until we get inside our home and can sort things out." Reluctantly, the Marine gave the order for the others to comply. John confiscated all the weapons and placed them in the front with us. William checked them for pistols. I told William to let them keep their knives. With six Marines wearing pillowcases over their heads, I sped off. Passing the point of the wreckage, I saw no sign of the radioactive builder corpse. It didn't take long to return to Hotel 23. As I approached the compound, the infrared lamps on the cameras shined brightly in our direction. The girls were watching us. We parked the vehicle and led the Marines through the fence and down the stairs into the large berthing area. I told them that they could take their hoods off. We took the magazines out of their weapons and gave the M16s back to them, bolts locked to the rear. I told them that they could have their mags back when they decided to leave. It was late, and I showed them where the cots and extra blankets were stored. I informed them that they were safe in an underground bunker, and that they could sleep tight tonight, and we would talk things over when they woke up. Early this morning, the Lance Corporal appeared at my door wanting to talk. He was reluctant to tell me where his unit was located, but he did say that there weren't many of them left. I told him that he was welcome to use our radios to contact his commanding officer. However, I would not allow them to know where this compound was located. I suggested to him that he should stay another day and get his thoughts straight and some food and water in him before making the decision to leave. I don't know the names of the other Marines, sans the last names embroidered on their uniform tapes. They are playing cards in the berthing area right now. I overheard one of them commenting on how nice this place is compared to base camp. I wonder just what is left of the military. Part of me wants to tell these men who I am. 01 July. 22:24 hours. Corporal Ramirez and the five other U.S. Marines departed this morning. I sat and talked with the men for a few hours last night. They were all young men. Ramirez, Williams, Bourbonnais, Collins, Akers, and Moe were their names. I didn't bother with first names, as I did not see the point. When asked about their commanding officer and base location, they declined to comment. Ramirez brought up the point that we didn't want them knowing the location of our stronghold either. I agreed, as it was only fair. I asked Ramirez about the government and if there was any form of it left. He told me that the last official government orders from the top were received in early February. Ramirez didn't think there was any formal civilian government left. He had heard rumors about the president's underground having been infected from the inside. That would explain the First Lady's final transmission after the president's death. I asked how a large unit like his could survive this long above ground. The Lance Corporal just smirked and said, "We are Marines. We just do." I was trying to get a bead on the size of his force by the wording of that question. He knew it. He was young, but he was intelligent. At around 10:30 this morning, the Marines, John and I, departed in two vehicles. We put the hoods over the men and led them to the Land Rover. John followed in the Bronco. We drove in circles and did our best to deceive our passengers. I was almost certain that they were honest men, but I had no idea what type of commanding officer they had. It didn't take long to get to the point that we agreed we would take them to, a point from which they knew they could find their way back home. When we arrived at the drop-off point, we took the pillowcases off their heads and gave them back their magazines. John left the Bronco running. We said our goodbyes to the men, and they all piled into the Bronco. One of the youngest Marines rolled his window down and said, "Thanks for the hospitality, sir." It was the way he emphasized the sir. I felt that he knew something. Perhaps it was just my paranoia and guilt kicking in. Following the young Marine's example, the other followed suit, and I could have sworn that Ramirez saluted me before stomping on the gas and heading off into the void of the undead Badlands. Cleek Light. 05 July. 22:19 hours. It has been busy here at Hotel 23. The day after the Marines departed, we started picking up chatter on the UHF band. Then, on the morning of the 3rd, we picked up a convoy of Lavs and Humvees going in the same direction Ramirez was headed days earlier, before we rescued them. I don't know what to make of it, except that they may have attempted to go and retrieve their abandoned vehicle, as it is quite valuable and irreplaceable in a world like this. On more than one occasion, I had thought of attempting to retrieve it myself. This idea was shot down, as the vehicle weighs literally tons, and it would have been impossible to fight my way in with the Land Rover, attach the chain, and crawl in low gear back to the compound. The Marines could do it. From the looks of the military convoy, they had plenty of torque-abundant vehicles to make this happen. The radios are still busy, but the transmissions are not voice. It sounds like an old dial-up modem trying to connect. I am almost positive they are using encryption on the radio. I would, if I had it. 06 July. 10:11 hours. We keep seeing part of the previous convoy passing in front of the complex, as if searching the area. I hope the Marines made it back to their base. One of two things can be deduced from what we are seeing. Either they are searching for their Marines, or they are searching for us. 07 July. 20:38 hours. I just received a radio transmission from the military. They are calling out to the civilians in the underground compound that rescued the Marines. At least we know they made it back. They say that the commanding officer requests a meeting with the man wearing green coveralls. We have not answered this transmission, and I bet they are just randomly transmitting every few miles to see if we will pick it up. I am very apprehensive about the intentions of the Marines due to their understandably cryptic answers when I probed for information. I really don't know what we are up against here, but I am certain that sooner or later they will think to check the chain-link fence area that they have passed by so many times. Hotel 23. 11 July. 21:21 hours. The military is still in this general area. From the information we have gathered from radio chatter on non-secure lines, it is safe to assume that they have put up a forward camp in this vicinity to find us. They have recorded a message and have it playing on most frequencies, including the distress frequency. We all had a meeting a couple of days ago and decided it was best to stay out of the military's path and eyes. They could easily find us, and I am sure they could eventually get into the compound using the same tactic as the civilian marauders. They would simply blast their way in using high-order explosives, in lieu of cutting torches. The undead are slowly building numbers at the front blast doors again. A week ago, there were only 10 or 15. Now, scores of them cluster around the heavy steel doors around the front of the complex. We have been leaving off the IR mode of night vision at night to reduce the chances of the Marines seeing our infrared camera beam on their own night vision devices. This has forced us to monitor living activity via thermal mode. This was the only thing that allowed us to see the small group of Marines pass within 400 yards of our complex last night. They are getting closer, but for some reason have not stumbled upon the field of chain-link fence and open silo door that marked Hotel 23. Something in the back of my mind tells me that perhaps they know what this place is, and that they could just be casing the area to determine weak spots to exploit. Normally, John only monitors a few HF channels at night. He cycles through them on a random schedule so that he can possibly catch a transmission that he normally would not. Last night, he did. It was severely garbled, but John swears he heard the words, Andrews Air Force Base. Andrews is very near D.C. I had assumed that D.C. had been nuked along with New York. I don't know how much longer we will be able to hold out before the military finds us. I suppose they might give up, but I find that prospect unlikely. Another haunting thought is that they refuse to mention the commanding officer's name and rank in their recorded transmissions. Perhaps he wishes to be anonymous, as I do. Siege. 14 July. 1940 hours. We have been discovered by what is left of the Marines in this area. 15 military vehicles are parked nearby, and shots are again being fired outside Hotel 23, directed at the undead. They have made no attempts to disable our cameras, so we have been watching them carefully. Of the 15 vehicles, 6 are LAMs. There are some military Hummers and even a four-wheeled ATV. I didn't count the ATV or the olive-drab dirt bike as part of the 15. They all appear to be in Marine-issued digital camouflage, which tells me that some order still might exist within the unit. The radio has been playing the same loop. I cannot get an accurate head count on them, as the dead are amongst them attempting to converge. The creatures that the Marines are dealing with outside are not the same as the one I had to avoid when on my last rescue mission. I have a feeling that if I were faced with an overwhelming army of the radiated dead, I would eventually fall to either their slightly faster mobility or their extreme radiation. The small numbers outside at this moment should not be a problem for the men dealing with them. We can escape now via the alternate exit and leave Hotel 23 forever, never knowing if the military outside are our allies, or we can stay and fight, or maybe attempt communication. We still maintain our radio silence and do not plan to break it unless absolutely necessary. They are making no attempts to gain entry at this time and have made no gestures toward the cameras. The sun will be down in roughly 2 hours, and if they plan to gain forced entry, I feel they will do it in the dead of night. One thing is absolute. Defeating foolish raiders with a lucky cheap shot is one thing. But going head-to-head with a couple of dozen well-armed U.S. Marines is quite another. 17 July, 22:36 hours. Negotiations at first were civil, then turned to threats that in turn led to violence. They began with radio transmissions directed at the ones in the bunker, then came the explosives. They set the explosives but did not detonate them. They wanted to get in without resistance. After seeing block after block of explosives being carted down into the silo hole, I had no choice but to break radio silence with the Marines. They keyed the microphone and said, to the best of my recollection, "To the men trying to take this facility by force, please cease hostile actions, or we will be forced to retaliate." I thought for sure I would hear laughter on the radio, but they were professional. "No one wants hostilities! We just want the complex. It is U.S. government property, and we have rightful claim to such properties in accordance with applicable federal laws and executive orders. We ask that you allow us to gain access, and no one will be harmed." That was the moment when I wanted to laugh at them on the radio. We were at a standoff. I had to speak to the person in command of this unit. I requested to do so and was met with evasive wording and lip service. "The commanding officer is at headquarters and will not be present." I asked for the person speaking to identify himself. He refused. I asked, "On what real authority do you claim this compound?" He replied, "On the authority of the Chief of Naval Operations." "Don't you mean the Commandant of the Marine Corps?" At first, there was silence. Then, the tiny voice came back and said, "The Commandant is missing in action. It is our best guess he is with his fellow cadre of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs at some secure location, along with most of the nation's leadership. Dead." "So, you are under naval operational control at this time?" "We are the Marine Corps, Department of the Navy." There was audible laughter at this point. I didn't see any point in hiding that we were the ones who had saved Ramirez and his men. These Marines probably knew that we were the same people, so I asked, "What about Ramirez and the other men that we saved from the disabled lav?" "They are fine, and one of them is with us now. Ramirez is back at base camp on perimeter defense duty, but wanted to pass something along face to face." With as much sternness as I could muster on the radio, I yelled into the mic, "Let me speak to a commissioned officer now, Marine!"
"I can't do that."
"Why not?"
"We don't have any... we don't have any here."
The Marine had slipped. I began to wonder who exactly was in command of these men. More banter went on until I finally convinced the Marine on the radio to put me on with the senior non-com present. Gunnery Sergeant Handley answered the call. The gunny bellowed,
"Now listen down there. We need the complex as a forward command center, as there's still a little bit of hope. A plan is being formed for the remnants of the U.S. military to attempt reclamation of the United States from the creatures."
I asked him how often they had communicated with the Chief of Naval Operations, CNO.
"We got regular but sunspotty HF comms with his carrier, and they're still flying very maintenance-limited sorties off the boat doing airborne reconnaissance on the mainland in an attempt to give accurate intelligence to what's left of the men on the ground. Hell, they've even dropped some iron a time or two for us when things got real bad."
I asked him, "So I suppose much of the Navy has survived the plague?" He replied,
"A lot of ships turned into floating caskets in the beginning. Of the 10 carriers in active service at the start of all this, only 4 were not infested and overrun by the dead. You might also want to know that there is a ballistic missile submarine that has been under for 7 months. They're living off powdered eggs and dried fruits and meat. That boat is the last normal piece of the life cycle. People can still die in peace there and not come back."
I asked the gunnery sergeant what he meant by that. He said,
"The boomer sub was under before all this happened, so somehow they're unaffected by whatever is causing the dead to rise. They radioed in on the very low frequency band that they had suffered one natural death in the month of February, but the corpse didn't rise. After a 24-hour observation, their doc put the corpse in the freezer and had it restrained with rigging web. The thing has been there since, motionless. Of course, they will have to surface sooner or later, or they'll run out of food. But for now, they are the last unaffected humans known to exist. All the other boomers and fast attack subs didn't hit the right time gate to avoid exposure. I guess we all have some form of this plague dormant inside us, waiting on the day our heart stops beating. The whole thing's fucked up as a football bat."
Then came a chilling silence, interrupted only by the random report of 5.56 rounds being fired at the creatures.
"Sir, we don't want to blow a big hole in your clubhouse and then take it from you. Isn't there some sort of peaceful agreement we can come to? There are civilians at our compound that are happy to be there."
I replied,
"We won't be happy there, Gunny. We aren't cattle. We have been surviving on the run since the beginning, and much of it was before we found this place."
"That is impressive, but it doesn't change the fact that this complex falls under military jurisdiction."
"Gunny, you still haven't given me proof that you all aren't some rogue group of military survivors with no governmental leadership backing your actions."
"Sir, government guidance and hesitation are what brought us into this shithouse and to the point of extinction."
"Yes, Gunny, you may have a point. However, we found this place, and we don't want to live under any iron fists, even if they belong to the U.S. military. He just replied with a, "Very well," and then came more radio silence. This was the night of the 16th. 2 hours after the last radio call, they detonated their first charge in the silo. It had no effect save for a barely visible crack in the 8-inch thick window glass of the blast door. Then another detonation, and another. The already damaged camera in the silo was disabled at this point, not even returning any variants of visible signal. The explosions were having no effect. Thinking of this, I wondered if the civilian marauders had even had a chance at getting in with their cutting tools before I killed them. The alloy and fiberglass-embedded concrete that made up Hotel 23 was very strong. I would suppose it would need to be to withstand a nuclear blast. I felt an ever-so-slight sting of guilt at the possibly needless killing of the civilian raiders. Perhaps they would have given up when their torches turned out to be ineffective. Maybe I didn't have to see them as walking burnt men. Rationalization tells me that they deserved it. Every synapse ping of pain. I snapped out of this thought at the sound of another explosion. I felt a slight pressure change. This change caused me to pinch my nose, close my mouth, and blow to equalize the pressure between my ears. The explosion did not damage the structure of the complex, but it did vibrate the alloy enough to induce a quick change in pressure inside. Jan and Tara were very upset at the thought of being captured and taken to a military-controlled camp. For all they knew, at this moment, they would be used as breeding vessels. I would never let that happen. The explosions weren't making anything better. Laura was crying, and Annabelle yelped in fear and stuck her tail between her legs every time another went off. After 30 minutes of this, the explosions ceased. They must have been fresh out of plastique. The radio once again crackled.
"Had enough yet? Why not just open the doors and come out peacefully? You will not be harmed."
I asked the gunnery sergeant to give us until sunrise to pack our things before we opened the door. He bought it. I gathered the adults, and we began brainstorming on what cards we could possibly play in this scenario. Options were limited. We could go on the run again and try to find another defensible location, but nothing would compare to Hotel 23. It would take us years to build anything as durable and safe. Jan suggested we take off in the aircraft. I explained to them that the Cessna could not possibly hold us all, let alone our gear, and that that option was out. Besides, the aircraft was not in excellent condition. The brake on one side was out. It was midnight, and we had 6 good hours to come up with something. I turned to John, who would normally have an outside-the-box answer to give me. He claimed that there was no logical answer. I was not sure that they knew the alternate exit existed, but there were vehicles parked in that area near the fence. They probably knew about it. The front door was a decent option, but there was a growing group of undead there, still banging on the door. The other option was to trust the Marines. If they kept their word, they would simply let us go after they seized the compound. I had no desire to be on the run again with an older lady, 2 small children, and a dog. We would be dead before the month ended at the claws and maws of those things. I just didn't know what to do. I sat in my living quarters pondering on any possible solution to our conundrum. If only I had possessed some sort of leverage. I hadn't put my belongings away since I let Dean have my other living area. A small box of what I had was still sitting in the corner of the room, waiting for the day I got tired of looking at it. Now, it seemed that day would never come. I stared at the box for a few minutes, thinking of how we were going to transport all of our gear with us cross-country and survive. Walking over to the box, I began to inventory its contents. 2 extra flight suits, gloves, knee board for flying, Glock 17 handgun, 3 small family pictures, 6 boxes of 9mm ammunition, and my Velcro name patch with, of course, my name, rank, and wings embroidered into the fabric. I hadn't worn this patch since civilization fell. What was the need?
Finally, I pulled my wallet out of the box. Looking inside my wallet, I found numerous cards. I was an NRA member back when it existed. It wasn't that long ago. I also had a card for what seemed like every video rental chain. Would I be exempt from the late fees if society ever rebuilt itself? I am sure the server that housed my felonious late fees data would be long rusted by the time the power grid was restored, if ever. Then came something that changed everything. Last month, I had remembered looking at my military identification card with a feeling of nostalgia. It was 2 years until it expired. I stood there, looking at it, running my thumb across the microchip embedded in the front. My data was on that chip, along with the data that was embedded in the barcode on the right side of the card. Again, there was my photo, a clean-shaven, naive version of myself, who would have never thought the dead would walk. If these men were still U.S. Marines, following the Uniform Code of Military Justice, then I was still a commissioned officer, and still their superior. If anyone still followed the rank structure of the military, it would be a Marine. In all my limited encounters with the Marine enlisted men in my military past, they had always stood up to address me when I spoke to them. The gunnery sergeant had said himself that there was no officer available topside, and that he was the senior man present. He was lying and didn't know it. I was, in theory, the senior man present. As I stood there with my back to the door, staring at the card in my hands, I saw Dean reach over and take the ID card and look at it. She carefully examined the military ID and looked at me. She said,
"Looks a lot like you, sailor."
I smiled back at her and said, "Yes, it used to be me." She replied,
"It's still you. It's just that you lost your military bearing, and it looks like you need a shave."
I thought for a moment that she could be right. I had done some bad things since January, but that didn't change the fact that there were military units still active, and I was still a military officer. My unit was destroyed, probably with no survivors. I knew this. I had flown over my base and seen it with my own eyes. The base had been overrun, then later nuked. Game over. For all I knew, I was the only one left. I called the group together and discussed what I planned to do. They all gasped at the thought, but eventually agreed that it was the only real way to handle the situation. It was 0500 hours this morning before I woke up and switched on the lights. I took my shower kit and began the laborious task of getting myself together. As I passed my old quarters, the door swung open and Dean stepped out with a pair of scissors from the control center office.
"Can't have you going topside without a haircut."
I laughed and made sure my towel wouldn't fall off in front of her. "I suppose not, Dean." She had cut Danny's hair when he needed it, and she made sure to tell me that he had never complained. My hair had grown long and far out of military regulation in the past months. I had shaved it off 3 months ago, but I had not touched it since, and it was rather long. It was unlike me to let it get this way. The end of the civilized world was a decent excuse, I thought, but Dean wouldn't have it. Like a master barber, she restored my head to unwritten aviation officer regulations, just a little longer than that of the enlisted men. As I finished up in the shower and hacked my thick stubble off, I looked in the mirror. I looked presentable for what I was about to do. I had no dress uniform or officer's sword, but I would make do. With my towel wrapped around me, I walked my way back to my quarters. Outside my door were my boots, shined to perfection with a note in child's writing. "I hope you like I shined my dad's boots before, Danny." He must have come in and retrieved them while I slept. I leave the door open so that I can hear if anything is going on in the walkway. I must be losing my edge, or he must be a very quiet kid. I thought back to when I had seen Danny urinating on the undead at the tower. What a funny sight. I put on my clean flight suit, with rank on my shoulders and name patch on my chest. I pulled my garrison cap out of the leg pocket where it had been for 6 months and put it on my head. I walked out of my quarters in uniform, prepared to meet the Marines. It was 0550 hours, and I could see on the cameras that the sun was coming up, making the clouds to the east shine with an ominous orange tint. I keyed the radio. "Gunny, are you there? Over." After a short pause, a tired, haggard, and perturbed voice came back.
"Yes, I am here, and I have been here all damn night."
"Good. Now clear your men away from the silo opening. I am coming up."
"We'll be waiting on you at the top.
Out." Armed only with a sidearm, I went to the access hatch that led directly into the silo. John and Will covered me with their weapons. It took three of us to spin the wheel and open the hatch, as all the heat and explosions had expanded and contracted the alloy. As soon as the hatch opened, a flood of light shone down from above and dust billowed in. John and Will quickly dogged the hatch. I hadn't seen the inside of the silo close up for quite a while. There were bits of burnt bone and clothing all over the bottom. Lots of teeth were scattered on the deck. There must have been quite a few creatures down here when the marauders started burning them. The walls were blackened from all the explosives that had been detonated during the past 24 hours. The men at the top could not yet see me, as I was near the bulkhead at the bottom. With cold anticipation, I stepped into the light and began climbing up the ladder to the top. The ladder was covered in ash. I kept climbing. The sound of "holy shit" signified that I had been sighted. I kept climbing until I reached the top. The gloved hand of a USMC gunnery sergeant reached out to help me over the lip of the silo doors. I stood there and looked him in the eye. He squared off in front of me and rendered a sharp salute. I returned it with the same bearing, and he dropped his. He immediately led me to his tent, and a handful of staff sergeants followed.
"Sir, we had no idea, I—"
"No need for that, Gunny. You didn't know I was an officer, and I wasn't going to tell you until I had to." A question and answer session followed, and I told him my story from day one. I left out the part about my XO ordering me to report to the base shelter. I told him that I was probably the last surviving member of my squadron, and that I had been surviving and picking up others when I could. It was then that he ordered the staff sergeants to leave the tent. He leaned in close to me and, with a very quiet and nervous whisper, said,
"Sir, I have not seen an officer for months. All of our ground pound of brass was ordered to an undisclosed location months ago, and we have not seen nor communicated with them since. Basically, they left us to die in the open out here. I have been telling the men that the commanding officer was alive and issuing orders directly to me via secure radio. It is not really lying, considering I have been receiving orders from an Admiral Godelman on board the flagship USS George Washington. They are starting to doubt my word. I had to keep the men's morale up. How would they fight or even work as a team knowing their unit's superior officers left them in the open to die and were probably dead themselves?"
We both sat there. I pondered what this implied. My concentration was broken intermittently by gunfire as the men fended off the undead. "What are you telling me, Gunny?"
"Sir, I'm telling you that you are the first officer I have seen in a long time, and we need you, if only as a mouthpiece leader for the men. Leader or not, I just need you to play the part, or this whole thing is going to unravel quick-like and blow up in everyone's face."
"Gunny, in that case, this place, Hotel 23, will be my command. You will need to stay and send most of your men back, along with your most trusted staff sergeant." He agreed. I told him that I would address the men while he decided who stayed and who didn't. Over the next half hour, I stood on an ammunition crate and watched the faces of the young patriots who looked on and listened. "I am the commanding officer of this stronghold, and I need a few good men." This was met with aggressive applause. "About 6.5 months ago, something really rocked our world. Now no one really knows what it was that happened, but it doesn't really matter what it is." I didn't think I sounded that great, but that the men disagreed with their whistles and clapping. "The way I see it, we may run out of rounds, but we still have sharp sticks. It may take a long time, but we won't give up. We're going to save as many as we can, and we're going to put the hurt on those things. I want you men to never forget that you are in the United States military. I don't want to hear any talk of there not being a United States. That is nonsense. Our Constitution may be sitting there in D.C. just fine, or it may be burned up, but that doesn't mean it's dead like those things out there. We will still support and defend till the end." This was met with cheers and claps, and also led to a crowd of men gathering around the gunny, volunteering to stay here at Hotel 23. The sun was now rising over the tree line on this summer morning. My simple address was over, and I could already see a visible boost in their morale. The compound was buzzing with purpose. The gunny said,
"One more thing, sir. Ramirez wanted me to give you this."
He handed me a fixed-blade knife with a heavy-duty leather sheath. The sheath had a small pocket containing a sharpening stone. I pulled the knife from the sheath and noticed that it was a very high-quality combat knife with a black micarta handle. The knife appeared to be stainless steel and had the words, "Randall Made, Orlando, Florida," stamped into the blade near the handle on one side. I laughed as I thought to myself, "They don't make them like this anymore. Hell, they don't make anything anymore." After all was said and done, three labs and a covered supply truck stayed here along with 22 men, including the gunny. We were topside when the staff sergeant and his convoy left for base camp with the news that they had found an officer to help with the cause. Two military radios loaded with crypto-keymat code from KYK-13's small cryptographic storage units were taken down into the compound and set up in the command center. The Marines quickly set up their berthing below. Most of the afternoon was spent returning Hotel 23 to an operational military combined operations center.
C-4-1. 18 July. 1605 hours. We have established communications with the USS George Washington. The acting chief of naval operations is currently away from the carrier on one of the small buoys planning with one of his commodores. I am certain there will be more to come in the following days. I'm told they are sending someone out to reprogram my Common Access Card, CAC, chip on my military identification card in the next anticipated supply run, but I'm not sure what good that will do or why it matters to me here. 22 July, 1720 hours. I have opened a Pandora's box. I now have more responsibility than I know what to do with. The 22 new Marines have been busy militarizing the perimeter and standing security watches. I now have a full-time radio operator with direct links to the carrier strike group. Message traffic has been heavy with updates to the status of the Gulf and eastern coastlines. Even daily threat assessments are being received indicating large undead swarm movements in some areas. I was curious about how the carrier was getting food for the 3,000-plus skeleton crew they were running. One of the young Marines told me that they had units of Navy strike teams stationed on board supply vessels, and they used these teams to infiltrate and exfiltrate via Zodiac boats, the government coastal supply centers, to identify good targets so that the larger cargo choppers can get in and airlift the food. I listened to the battle group radios for a few hours today, monitoring Navy and Air Force aviation communications, in particular voice traffic from a U-2 reconnaissance aircraft flying over the eastern seaboard. I was curious to know how they were able to keep the Dragon Lady airborne with the hefty maintenance and long airfield requirements. Apparently, the U.S. Army didn't fare very well, and according to a report received day before last, they have suffered a loss of over 70% of ground troops in CONUS. There just wasn't enough room for them on the ships. The sailors and Marines took priority, and the U.S. Army units were left to defend themselves inland. They were given advance warning of the nuclear strike, but many of them were overcome by the radiated undead that were pouring out of the radiation zones after the strike. Some of the voice communications I was monitoring indicated that there were still search teams out surveying the ground for military survivors. One particular communique received was from a surveillance aircraft flying over the Virginias in search of a lost tank convoy. Apparently, the convoy met its demise after one of the lead tanks crushed an overpass under its massive weight. The structure of the ill-repaired overpass gave way and took four tanks with it. The convoy was being pursued by thousands of hot undead, and it only took a couple of hours before the swarm caught up with them. Three tanks were disabled in the fall from the overpass, and their occupants were left to die in metal tombs, with countless bodies pounding on the heavy armor and squirming over the turrets and tracks like maggots over roadkill. The remaining tanks scattered to the winds and got the hell out. Location unknown. The crew in the back of the aircraft commented on the radio that the occupants of the disabled tanks might already be exposed to high levels of radiation due to the sheer number of dead below. The aircraft sensors indicated that the horde was emitting deadly amounts at ground level. After surveying the situation, the aircraft headed back to base, reporting that they were on Bingo, emergency fuel. One thing is for sure. The number of new inhabitants here will force us out soon to find a water tanker to fill Hotel 23's tanks back up to maximum capacity. Hitting the tank with my rifle today revealed that the level is down to the bottom eighth. We are already rationing water and have set up numerous rain catches around the compound to help fill the critical need. A technician showed up at the command center after flying in today to reprogram my identification card. There is a chip embedded in the card. The technician inserted my card into a reader-writer connected to a laptop and instructed me to enter a PIN number at least 6 digits long. I thought of a number that I knew I'd never forget and entered it into the terminal. The technician informed me that I would have full control over all sensitive systems at the compound by using my card and PIN at the computer terminals in the command center. He warned that I am the only person that would have this access until I was relieved. I asked him why this mattered, and he stated that he didn't know, but that his instructions from headquarters were to give the ranking officer at the compound this access. The only way to designate another person would be for my card to be used in the command center to give permission for the transfer of authority to another officer designated by higher authority. If my card or PIN number were to be lost or destroyed, it would take 90 days to reprogram another, as the system has a time-lock failsafe to avoid the unauthorized transfer of power. The technician said nonchalantly as he walked out the door, "Too bad you are empty. This authorization would have given you nuke launch authority, although I wouldn't want it." 26 July, 14:22 hours. I cannot be certain that having men topside standing watch is a good idea. The men are firing 50 rounds per 24-hour period, and I feel this may be a cycle of waste and danger. Last night I ordered them inside to see if not having them up there would lessen the undead activity in the area. It seemed to work better. This morning there were 10 undead at the fence. Killing 10 is better than shooting 50. The men are using bayonets to dispatch the undead at the fence, then dragging them near the tree line 50 yards off using ATVs and webbing that they wrap around the corpses' chests so that they avoid any chance of getting scraped inadvertently by the inanimate body. Communication from the aircraft carrier has been sporadic, as our ground unit is an insignificant speck compared to what the rest of the military is dealing with. Andrews and DC apparently were not hit, according to message traffic, and there is currently a team of scouts on the ground surveying what it would need to retake the District of Columbia. Another option discussed is moving the capital out west, but little is known about that region of the country. Communication with the other Marines is constant and steady, with the non-commissioned officer in charge checking in every hour on the hour. I have made it clear to the gunny that having the other men and civilians closer to our position may not be a bad idea. I tried to connect to the internet backbone again today. Down. This would have been an excellent means of long-range communications with other countries and units, since our main enemy cannot read or use a computer. The water supply is getting dangerously low, and a team is being assembled and briefed for deployment tomorrow in the AM. I will be accompanying. 30 July, 1934 hours. Our small unit left in search of water on the morning of the 27th. John was the temporary appointed civilian leader holding down the law at Hotel 23. He promised he would take care of our folks while we went looking for the H2O. Our path took us north, lateral to the radiation zone outskirts. We took 3 labs and 13 men. Our goal was simple. We were headed toward the interstate to find a water truck or any truck that could hold water. Hotel 23's tanks were nearly dry, and it was going to take 10,000 gallons to fill the reservoir up to capacity. I was informed of the location of the original Marine base camp days ago. Our journey took us within 40 miles of their location. 40 miles equaled 80 miles round trip, so a visit was out of the question for now. After an hour of pulling wreckage out of the way and dodging pileups, our lab convoy finally made it to what remained of Interstate 100. This stopped being fun before it started. I hate doing this with the white-hot intensity of 1,000 suns. I could see a group of them walking about, weaving in and around the abandoned cars. They were 400 yards off, and if I imagined and concentrated, I could make myself believe for a few minutes that they were not dead. Soon our scent, could they really smell, would be carried on the wind to them, and they would start the slow but determined march toward the living. It seemed like a balancing act. I sometimes think of the living and the dead as chromosomes. Only the dead are the dominant chromosomes. No matter what, all you get in this world are brown-eyed babies. They are dominant if numbers dictate. In this day and time, they seem to do just that. Dean really wanted to come along with us. She could probably handle herself, but I quickly made up another important task for her to accomplish, so I didn't have to tell her it wasn't a good idea. Tara and I are probably considered an item now. I suppose I knew it was coming. That is, in itself, another story. Perhaps I will write about it someday. Jan, Will, John, and Tara are showing the Marines at Hotel 23 the basic operation of the facility, as well as the escape routes in the event of the worst-case scenario. I was thinking of Tara as we closed on the interstate. I was 200 yards out when I saw a surrounded vehicle. Reminded me of her. I truly thought she was dead back at the dock that day we found her. We advanced closer, and I had to see what was in the car. I could tell the window was cracked on the side visible to our convoy by the undead arms that were reaching in, only to be stopped at the elbow by the partially opened window. One lav ran interference and drew the group away from the car so that we could have a look inside. Of course, it worked. The radiation measurement equipment on board indicated that this area was nearly free of radiation. Some residual radiation remained, and would for hundreds of years if no cleanup was done. We were closer to the car now. The men covered us as myself and 2 other Marines jumped off the vehicle and headed for the car. I was pleased to find a mother bird and her chirping babies safely nestled in the back seat of the vehicle. I was sure that those creatures were making it extremely difficult for the mother to leave and find food, but she seemed to be doing all right. I thought of rolling the windows up just a little more to make it more difficult for the creatures, but, much to my disappointment, the windows were electric and the battery long dead. Looked like I was leaving this one up to unnatural selection. We radioed the herding lav to rally with us 1 mile east of original position. The highway was thick with undead, but a strange sense of security came with riding in these capable vehicles. We had plenty of weapons and ammunition, as it would be dangerous not to.
We searched east along the interstate until we were perilously close to the outskirts of Houston. Houston was not hit in the offensive months ago, and it most assuredly had an abundance of undead at its core. We had found numerous 18-wheeler trucks with fuel trailers probably full of gasoline. It was too bad we couldn't drink fuel. Reminded me of the real world, before all of this, when a bottle of water was much more expensive than its equivalent in gas. Either way, we did find a truck that held a lot of water, and it made me feel a little ignorant for not thinking of it before. I don't know why we didn't just seek out a small town fire department rather than risking our asses on the interstate. I didn't let on I was thinking this in front of the men, but it would have been much safer the other way. Sitting in front of us was a nice, dirty fire truck marked San Felipe Fire Department. It was a large truck, but not the largest I had seen. We attempted to start the truck. No joy. It turned out to be a difficult task to turn the vehicle around and get it hooked up to one of the labs, a task that has aged me a few years. Continued soon. The fire truck was a tomb. Inside were two dead firemen, who actually were dead and not moving. I was not close enough yet to know how they took their own lives and avoided reanimation, but it seemed they succeeded. The interstate was thick with them, but they were not the ultra-deadly variety of undead that would have been found near the radiated zone west of this position. The only other option besides towing the vehicle would be to attempt to trickle-charge the battery from the equipment on board the labs. First, we needed to quietly clear out the immediate danger in the area. From my perch on the crew-served weapon of number 2 lav, I counted 38 undead. I radioed Gunny, and he claimed to count 39. When we left Hotel 23, the Marines had regular M4 and M16 carbines, not unlike what the hotel armory held when we first opened it months before. I knew that this was not a unit composed of all original members. The Gunny had relayed to me in the first days of their arrival that the unit was made up of surviving Marines of several units that followed radio signals and ended up in Texas. Of course, not all of them found the surviving military cell in this way, as many times when the core of the unit went out to find supplies, they found survivors. Many times the survivors were military or former military. This explained the weapons that the Marines in Lab Number 1 pulled out of the vehicle. 4 Marines that I had previously remembered having dive bubbles and jump wings on their chest pulled out suppressed H&K MP5s. I would have loved to have had even one of these weapons in the first months of the end of the world. I held up my fist in the sign to hold fire while I radioed the Gunny. I asked him how many suppressed weapons the unit had. He told me that the recon Marines had raided their local armory before they had bugged out and took all the suppressed weapons that they could, likely in preparation for a quiet guerrilla campaign. I radioed Lab Number 1, Point, and gave the men permission to fire suppressed rounds at the undead surrounding the fire truck. I hadn't even finished my radio call when I started hearing the eerie sounds of the action of suppressed submachine guns. One by one, the undead fell. Many times the Marines missed. During the shooting, the Gunny read my thoughts and informed me that these suppressed 9mm weapons were not nearly as accurate as the M16, but they were quiet and didn't draw unwanted attention. The sound was very nearly the same as if you were to pull the charging handle on a regular M16 quickly in succession. A barely audible popping sound was heard. It took 4 minutes to clear the area around the fire truck. We parked the labs around the truck, and we all got out. The Marines had re-stowed the suppressed weapons, as firing them too much would render the suppression ineffective in the long term, according to them. 8 men set up a defensive perimeter in the lav gaps. I approached the fire truck and reached up to open the door. It was locked. Same story. The pus marks of dead arms were present on the doors of both sides, indicating that the dead firemen inside had held out in the abandoned truck until they had apparently taken their own lives. Using a large wrench taken from one of the vehicle's tool bags and some 100-mile-an-hour duct tape,
I quietly broke the glass so that I could open the driver's side door. I reached in to unfasten the door lock and was grabbed on the wrist by one of the firemen. I tried my best to pull my hand back through the broken opening. The thing almost had its mouth on my wrist when a Marine opened fire and shattered the creature's head. Both of us had thought the firemen were dead. The loud noise must have awoken the creature from some sort of undead hibernation. The passenger side fireman inside really was dead, as most of his upper body and head were gone, probably rotting in the other creature's throat and stomach. After opening the door and pulling the driver's side ghoul to the ground, I nudged the passenger with the barrel of my rifle. No movement. He still clutched a blood-stained axe. The advantage of having a unit of variously skilled and capable military men became apparent when I realized that I knew nothing of large engine vehicles. One of the marine mechanics went to work, popping the engine compartment, checking the salvage potential. Low on oil, dead battery, and no fuel was the prognosis. The fuel was no problem. We used some of our lav reserves to partly fill the tank. The oil would have to wait, as neither I nor the mechanic knew what oil we needed without taking the time to read the manual. That was not an option now, as I could hear the perimeter guards shooting a small group of dead that had been drawn here by the sound of the fireman's execution. The last thing to handle was the battery charge. The Marine was not certain of the battery's condition, sitting out in the elements unchecked for 6 months. We attempted to charge the battery. A waiting game began. It would take 30 minutes to charge the large battery enough to turn the stagnant engine over. In the meantime, we all stood defensive duty, sans the mech working on the fire truck. He was also charged with setting up the towing chains needed in the event the battery would not charge. Shot after shot, there was a virtually unlimited supply of undead. The city was in view on the horizon, smoke still spiraling up to the sky from fires left unopposed. I wondered which one this fire truck was meant for. Probably one long burned out. Another shot, then another. They were coming, thicker, heavier, faster. Just 10 more minutes. The sound was droning ever louder. Moans on the wind and intermittent sounds of metal banging or falling in the distance, those things tripping over road debris. Looking back over my shoulder, I could see the mech attaching the chains to the underbelly of the rig. He didn't run the other end to the waiting lav. He simply wrapped the length of chain around the hooks that were welded to the front bumper of the fire truck. Then came the sound of the engine sputtering and turning over. It worked. The engine turned and brought a new noise variable to the problem. Looking back, I saw smoke rise from the exhaust pipes. The huge red behemoth was waking up to a world very different from what it had known before. The mechanic was grinning. I shot him an approving look and told the men to return to their vehicles. I sprinted to lav number 2, waving the men past me, and then I jumped in, screaming, "Last man!" I could not be sure about the mechanical reliability of the fire truck. I radioed the mechanic to take the third position in the convoy. Lav 1, 2, I was in 2. Then the fire truck, and last, lav 3, made up the formation. I didn't want the large truck to break down, entombing another poor soul. I know the truck was probably fine and had just run out of fuel sitting in gridlock on the interstate. The poor firemen were surrounded with no way out. The rest is pure speculation. We were on the move, headed for H-23. Along our route, the gunny and I took note of the numerous fuel tanker rigs by marking them on our maps. We would eventually need a lot of diesel fuel. That would be for another day. I don't think the power drain is affected by the recent population boost back home. The generators only run a few hours per day to power the batteries for the lighting, air, water circulation, and limited cooking that is done. We have been surviving on MREs and limited dry goods since the beginning, and they are getting old. But I know these Marines have probably eaten them longer in normal peacetime conditions. We made it to the same point at which we first encountered the interstate. The sun was getting low, and that was a catalyst for something bad to happen. It did. The fire truck died. I sent two men from my lab to attach the chain to our towing point. This vehicle had no problem in the torque department. I was sure one of the younger Marines probably knew every nut and bolt of this machine, but I only knew one thing. It was tough. The large steel chain jerked and popped every time the tension did not balance the weight of the massive emergency vehicle towed behind. I felt our vehicle surge and the independent gearing kick in, dispersing the traction to the wheel that needed it. The undead were here in force. I could not count to five without hearing our vehicle impact one of them with a commanding thud. Looking through the thick armored glass window, I observed them bouncing off the vehicle, some of them thrown nearly 20 feet into the overgrown ditches along the road. We were only half an hour out from H-23 when I radioed the mech, asking him to check the water gauge on the truck. The mech couldn't read the gauge, as the water control panel had no power. I hoped that the truck at least had enough water to last us until we could repair the truck and find another water source. I was certain that the compound's water would run out any time, if it hadn't already. Using the night vision capability of the lav, I was able to pick up H-23's camera beacons. We were on course and tracking. We made it back home with the truck in tow. The fire truck had a 5,000-gallon capacity and was one quarter full. This would be enough to last us until we could find another water source. With the medical kits we have at H-23, as well as the kits the Marines have, we should be able to purify the water using iodine. It would be wise to kick in a few suburban doors and grab some household bleach at some point. Messages are constantly coming in from headquarters, most of them only for our information and not calling for action. I have had to send in one status report concerning Austin, Texas. The brass on the carrier needed the data to update their all-important status boards. I have a feeling we could be sent into a radiated area for the same type of status information. I suppose I will cross that bridge when it falls out from under me. Cutter. 08, August. 1350 hours. I was inside Hotel 23. Trapped. The dead Marines outside were pounding on the door to the environmental control room. Sliding the steel peephole to the side, I could see her. Tara was there. Bloody, dead, wanting. John was behind her, pawing at the door. I couldn't remember how I had gotten here. I only knew that I was here. Surrounding the familiar faces were the Marines. Many of them were riddled with fatal bullet holes. My radio operator was there also. He still had his headset strapped to his head. Then, he talked. The dead radio man talked. He said, "Sir, wake up. I have some important information for you." I am not certain of the nature of the message that arrived last night while I was sleeping. I woke up to the sound of the radio man tapping on my door. The message stated that we were to deploy to the coastline to help out a wrecked Coast Guard cutter. They were in no immediate danger and were anchored off the coast of Texas, only 80 miles up the coast from where the Bahama Mama probably still rested on the shore. After I had read the message and discussed its contents with the gunny, we decided it would be best to leave tonight. Shaken from the dream, I told Tara what I had seen in my vision. She was more than a friend, and I felt I could tell her anything. Also, Dean was a rock. Her wisdom helped me deal with the demons that rack my soul more often than not these days. The feeling was similar to coming off a long vacation to find that work had piled up in my absence. As I write this, my third in command is charting our course overland to rendezvous with the cutter that is dead in the water. In any other situation, we would have departed already, but since the men on board were relatively safe, we were taking the time in planning and provisioning to ensure a safer trip. I would like to keep this excursion to a maximum of 48 hours. There is still much that needs to be done with merging the two camps. Hotel 23 cannot accommodate all the people, but I feel that with the right heavy equipment and some concrete dividers taken from the interstate, we could form a large wall around the perimeter outside the chain-link fence. It could take months to gather the needed barriers, but it might be worth it. On another note, Danny hurt himself today playing with Laura outside. They were chasing Annabelle, and Danny tripped in a small hole in the ground, spraining his left ankle. They are getting to go topside more these days, but the Marines are under strict orders to ensure their safety whenever they are above ground. I have already packed my equipment into Lav Number 2. I have affectionately and secretly named this lav Bumblebee Tuna. I don't know why. It just fits for some odd reason. It is very hot outside today, and we will be bringing some extra water along with us in order to stay hydrated and alive. I know our water situation is not as good as it should be, and neither is our fuel situation. This is a problem that will need to be resolved between official duties. In a way, I am happy that Hotel 23 is a small drop in the strategic command bucket. I am taking the same Marines with me on this mission. I didn't notice any huge screw-ups from any of them on the last mission, so I don't see the need to fix something that isn't broken on a mission with such short notice. Perhaps I will mix them up on the next mission, if there is one. 11, August. 22:28 hours. The departure from Hotel 23 was uneventful. It was very humid outside, and it felt as if we were entering a sauna when we opened the hatch leading topside from the compound. The vehicles were already fueled up and ready for departure. The roads were in severe need of maintenance that would never be given. The concrete was cracked, and I hadn't seen roads this bad since my overseas duty in Asia. We continued east to the coastline until we came across what used to be a major roadway. Now it more closely resembled a field with wrecked cars lined up pointing east. It wasn't what I was used to seeing. The rusting hulks were the only indication of the direction and curve of the road. We crept along beside the wrecks in the general direction of the road, making sure to keep a safe distance from them to avoid any problems. The undead were not intelligent, and this was not a known radiation zone, but the rolling hills of Texas could hide them easily in the troughs between here and our destination. Another thing in the back of my mind was the difference in the big picture. In the old world, there were only a handful of animals that could deliver a fatal bite, such as some breeds of snake. Now the pendulum of deadly creatures to vulnerable humans has swung toward cataclysm. At least with a deadly viper, one might have a possibility of survival. From the stories I am hearing from the Marines, these creatures that haunt the world have no antidote. The gunny claims to have seen hundreds of men, strong men, who succumbed within 36 hours of being bitten or scratched. There is even a documented case of a few victims being infected by the accidental transfusion of saliva to open wounds. Something still haunts me about them. Where do they get their energy? They seem to have unlimited supplies of energy in death. I secretly hope that someone or some think tank is working to assess the strengths and weaknesses of these things, which most likely outnumber us by millions in the U.S. and billions abroad. These were among the thoughts swimming around in my mind during our mission to rescue the cutter Reliance, dead in the water. We were quite a few miles from our destination when we saw the first group of them in our NVGs. I carefully outlined the unit's rules of engagement, ROE. They knew to only use force against them when absolutely necessary. The loud engines of our labs triggered the undead to jerk on their axis and move toward us as we passed. They were conditioned and knew that any loud noise most definitely meant food. I just glared at them from the gunner's turret, then stared ahead into the night. The goggles were good, but one could see only so far with them, unlike the naked eye in daylight. It was sort of like having a huge green torch that lit up the night out to nearly 800 yards. It was the same thing, corpse after corpse, wandering in the areas around their respective demises. Traveling with 8-wheeled vehicles had its advantages. We were fine trekking off-road until we came to bridges or overpasses. Approaching these structures meant that we would have to either pull the clogged arteries of the highway free from the vehicles that blocked them, or descend into the depths of the riverbeds. Sometimes it wasn't a riverbed that the overpass was hiding. It was an interchange or a smaller highway that ran underneath. That is what we happened on the night of our trip to the cutter. Lav number one radioed back 200 yards before reaching the decision point. They also knew never to stop. They idled forward as the radio man's crackled voice came through.
Sir, we are approaching an overpass. The road is congested. What do you want to do?
I asked. What types of vehicles are clogging the pass? He replied.
Sir, I see a couple 18-wheelers.
I had no choice but to order the men down into the embankment that led to the perpendicular road below. I told the men to take it diagonally as they descended and to stop for nothing. As much as I hated to think about it, these machines were still in need of depot-level maintenance, professional civilian maintenance, and on more than one occasion they have been known to sputter and die when coming to an abrupt stop. Just as Lav number one disappeared 50 meters ahead of me into the abyss below, the radio keyed up, and then, only static. I keyed the microphone, asking for the station calling to repeat. Lav one came back.
Sir, you might want to step on it and get around this. There's a school bus full of those things, and there are quite a few of them around it.
I gave thanks for the warning and asked the sergeant to keep me updated. We were almost on the crest of the hill and in view of them. The radio again crackled.
Sir, we got active Geiger!
I sat there for a minute, stunned. We were further away from radiated zones than Hotel 23. Why were we getting Geiger readings this far out? As the nose of Lav 2, mine, tipped over the ridge and began heading down the ravine to rendezvous with the highway, I saw the school bus. It was nothing special at first, until I took a second look. The bus was ready for battle. Its windows had chicken wire and chain link welded to the sides, and a makeshift snowplow attached to the front. Our Geiger was now going off as we neared the big yellow bus. The bus was giving off high amounts of radiation. There were numerous undead occupants. On a more disturbing note, I could see nearly a dozen corpses on top of the bus, permanently dead. I could not even begin to speculate on this one. The bus was hot, but the undead surrounding it were not nearly at the same level. The Geiger counter indicated the bus was giving off radiation levels that would make it deadly for prolonged exposure. Some of the occupants of the bus appeared to have very traumatic wounds, but some of them looked unscathed. They were very excited at the sound of our vehicles cruising by. The last sight I had of the bus was the second-to-last window on the right side. A young boy was hanging out of the window by his right leg. Nothing but bone was left on his left leg. His face was full of lesions and blisters. He didn't appear to be dead or undead. Maintaining radio contact, we eventually skirted the wreckage and eluded the undead as we began climbing the hill to return to our easterly course. Something about the bus disturbed me. I wondered if the bus had been filled with survivors attempting to reach a safer area. They obviously came from a radiated zone and knew that to stay meant death. I wondered how those on the roof of the bus had taken themselves out. I didn't see any guns there with them. It was a few hours before I could think of anything else. We went on, all through the night, towing, skirting, avoiding. The only other complete stop we made was when we arrived at a fuel tanker that was at a safe distance from any bottleneck of pileups and traffic jams. Since we didn't have any time to figure the vehicle out or to try to bring it back to life, one of the men simply attached a cloth-wrapped chain to the valve of the vehicle and yanked it from the tank. Diesel began to flow onto the ground. We all knew that diesel was not very volatile and posed no real threat as long as we were smart about handling it. Using one of the K-bars, we cut one of the rubber hoses from the side of the tanker and taped it to the broken valve with 100-mile-per-hour tape. It wasn't pretty or watertight, but it did the job. We filled the vehicles and the exterior fuel tanks with the fuel. One of the mechanics tested the fuel and claimed that it was still okay, but it probably wouldn't be in a year or so, without treatment. We stuffed the broken valve with cloth that we cut from the seats of the vehicle, a large 120-ounce drink cup and a piece of rope. It dripped a little, but it would take ages to leak dry. We marked it on our charts as a possible refuel point if needed on the way back. The prospect of having a known fueling point made me feel a little better, but with the shoddy maintenance on the vehicles, coupled with questionable fuel quality, any positive feelings were diminished. As the sun came up, we arrived at Richwood, Texas. The sign indicating the name and population was partially obscured by graffiti crossing it out. I could smell the salt air. We were not far from the Gulf. We had been attempting to contact the cutter via radio all night. No joy. The men were tired, and movement during the day was risky. We were in an industrial area, and it didn't take long to find a fenced-in factory in which to play hide-and-sleep. The factory was called PLP, and judging from the equipment sitting outside the main building, they had something to do with industrial piping. One of the Marines knocked the lock off with an axe that was strapped down to the exterior of Lab 3. We drove through, shut the gate, and reattached the chain using tape and spare tent stakes. We parked the labs around back and set up a watch rotation as well as defensive perimeters using the stacks of pipes that littered the exterior. We got very little sleep that day because of the incessant banging from inside the factory. The undead workers knew we were out here and wanted to be also. By the time we woke up and cleared the heavy stacked pipes out of our way, we had an audience at the fence near our area. Not many, but enough. One is too many. Another random thought. How many humans could one of them infect if victims walked in a line, allowing the creature to bite everyone? Unlimited? 50? We sent 4 men to distract the undead audience so that the rest of us could open the gates and exfiltrate the factory. The sun was hanging low. It was 13 hours since we had stopped. We needed the extra time to allow full sleep rotation. We could have saved 4 hours by just letting everyone sleep at the same time, but that would have been foolhardy. We were out of the area quickly and on our way to the coastline. It had been a bit since I had seen the ocean. The familiar smell brought back memories, like the smell of old cologne found in the back of a medicine cabinet. Once again, we tried to establish communication with the cutter. Our HF radios could easily reach Hotel 23 if tuned properly, and should have been able to reach the cutter even more easily. The only thing I could think of was signal bounce, a phenomenon well known to radio operators. Being too close or too far from the intended recipient of a transmission could put the signal in a position to bounce over the receiving radio antennas. There was overcast, and sometimes this was a factor in a signal bounce problem. We checked in with John and the rest of the hotel originals. I told them of the school bus and the fuel truck and factory. I asked John if Tara was in the room, and he said that she wasn't. I then told him to tell her not to worry and not to mention the school bus to her. The main purpose of my call was to get an accurate position for the cutter. John said he would have the radio man send out a message and would get back to me within the hour. As we idled along toward the ocean, her green color came into view. The vast expanse of the Gulf lay before us. Her palette of color had been long missed. Judging by the reactions of the men, they too missed the view of open waters. Approaching the marina, John came back over the radio and relayed the response from the carrier. Carrier intelligence had received the last Link 11 data link update 30 minutes prior. The cutter was at 2850 north, 095 16.4 west. According to our charts, this put the ship 4 miles off the coast. We were close enough to the marina to see the details. Only small sailboats remain there. This area reminded me of Sea Drift. Why wouldn't it? It was not far from there. I wondered if the pickled onions were still sitting on the deck of the Mama. She wasn't far from here either. We were going to need a while to plan this amphibious rescue mission, so we pulled our 3-vehicle convoy into the parking lot of the Fair Winds Marina. I radioed John again and asked him to get a message to HQ requesting updates if the cutter's position drifted more than half a mile. He told me to be careful, and he would see me in a couple of days. With the lack of communication between our convoy and the cutter, I wondered if this was in fact a rescue mission or a salvage mission. I was startled from this thought by the sound of carbine fire. I cursed under my breath and wondered which man had broken the ROE. I picked up the microphone and keyed out, asking who had fired and why. The senior man on Lab 3 came back, asking me to turn the scope directly to 6 o'clock and see what was approaching. I complied and saw probably 50 of them pouring out of the urban area a quarter mile from our position. 50 was better than 5,000 on any day, so I wasn't too worried. The sergeant wasn't shooting at the undead 1,500 feet away. He was shooting at the ones pounding on his back doorstep. I don't know why, but the group of 4 corpses behind Lab 3 looked familiar. I couldn't place them. I had seen thousands of these things since they first walked, and I was probably just being paranoid. I signaled the men to prepare the vehicles for amphibious travel. These marine labs were just as seaworthy as most small boats. They were large, heavy, and slow, but they could move in the water. They have 2 small screws in the back, boosting the vehicles to speeds approaching 10 knots. We opened up on the ones in our area and the chain of them that popped up between the water and us. Our path was clear and our vehicles ready, so we barreled into the Gulf of Mexico, undead hordes behind in pursuit. The water that splashed up onto my face was warm. Water began to spill into the troop compartment, and I shot a worried glance over to the gunny. He smiled and told me not to worry, that if it weren't leaking, he would be the one worried. I trusted the man and popped my head back topside to observe the activity on the shore. I told the other labs to cut to idle and form a line 100 yards from the marina. The inside of my vehicle had 2 inches of water, but it showed no sign of sinking. I climbed out onto the top and just watched them gather on the shoreline like ants. It was then that the radio beeped again with another voice message incoming. It was the familiar sound of crypto syncing up. It sort of sounds like an old computer modem until the voice comes into recognition. John came back and told us he had a position update on the cutter. Even though we had only requested updates in the event of a drift greater than a quarter mile, HQ felt that the news of the cutter's not moving at all would also be valuable. I had to agree. The ship had no significant movement since the last time an automated update was sent from the antenna on the mast of the ship. The moans from the dead carried well over the water and into my microphone. I heard Tara's voice and a struggle for the microphone back at the compound. She came on and asked if everything was all right. I explained our current situation and informed her that we were in no immediate danger. I asked her to put John back on, and she reluctantly did. I told John that we were about to head out into the open water in search of the ship. Fog was beginning to roll in. The light of the moon, as well as the cold of the night, magnified the fear that every man felt. We left the gaggle of undead at the shoreline and headed for the coordinates given to us by the carrier battle group. As we slowly advanced, the moans were drowned out, and we forgot about our enemy for the time being. I tried not to think about the undead that were lurking on the ocean floor or floating with neutral buoyancy just below the surface. I wished them the worst, as those were the ones I feared most. The lab's onboard optic was much better than my goggles, so I scurried back in the hole and deployed the sensors. I could still see the shoreline. The undead were still there. Again, like ants, they swarmed. I swung the viewer back around toward the front of the vehicle. My feet were wet from the salt water that had leaked or splashed into the compartment. We were now 1 mile off the coast, and I could see a small, shining object on the horizon. It almost looked like a candle. When we reached the 2 mile marker, the radio came alive again with a position report. John claimed that the Coast Guard cutter had again remained stationary since the last update. That was fine by me. The less hunting for it in the open water, the better. I grabbed a strobe light from one of the survival kits and clipped it on the cargo net topside. I wanted to do everything I could to get indications that the crew was alive before attempting to board. I still could not see the silhouette of the cutter. We were now at the 3-mile distance from the shoreline. The source of the candlelight became apparent. The light was the flame from an offshore oil platform. At her base was the cutter. It appeared to be moored on the southeast support column of the rig. There was no sign of life from this distance. As we approached the rig, I could hear living human voices in the distance. They appeared to be yelling. I was nearly certain that our strobes could be seen from their vantage point on the vessel. As I got closer, I began to realize that the voices were not coming from the ship, but from the platform. I listened and went back inside to use the lav optics. I could see the green outline of men on the platform waving their arms. We were now close enough to make out what they were saying. They were telling us not to board the ship. It was overrun. I wondered how a mechanical malfunction had turned out to be an infestation on board this warship. The gunny and I were the first to touch the ladder of the oil platform. On my way up, I could make out figures on the boat. It was a long climb to the top, even longer than the ladder in the missile silo of Hotel 23. As I reached the top rung, I was helped to my feet by one of the crew. I counted roughly 30 men on the platform. They all appeared to be in good health. I asked who was in charge, and one of the men replied,
"Lieutenant J.G. Barnes, sir."
I asked to speak with the lieutenant, but the men quickly informed me that he had sealed himself inside a compartment on the vessel and had no way out. I had a feeling that my next question had been anticipated, as when I asked them how the hell those rotting shitbags could take over a warship, they started to explain the situation piece by piece. I was talking to a petty officer. He was one of the ship's information systems technicians who ran the ship's automated systems and networks. He seemed to have it together. The petty officer explained that they had run aground near the offshore rig. The updated charts they would normally have on board were not available, and they were not sure how deep the water was in this area. It wasn't bad, but they ended up damaging their screw while getting themselves off the sandbar. The boat could be operated, but that would cause too much stress on the engine and shaft because the screw was not functioning at 100% efficiency. There would be no time like the night for us to retake the vessel. I knew for a fact these things could not see in the dark any better than the average living person. Despite the petty officer's explanation of how they came to be nearly dead in the water, the question remained about the undead and why they were present on the cutter in sufficient numbers to cause the crew to abandon the vessel. I ordered him to explain this. He was hesitant at first, but I explained to him who I was and under what authority I operated. After lowering his head so that his eyes were hidden below his ball cap, he said,
"Word came down from the top to get and transport specimens of them for research on the flat-top carrier."
Insane. Really? Would the people in charge actually want these things on board their command ship, no matter how critical the research? Bringing them onto a cutter was one thing, but on board the acting U.S. military command ship? I know that the carrier had a full onboard medical staff and decent equipment for research, but this research could be done somewhere else, anywhere else, away from the military's leadership. We were getting thin on active-duty military personnel, or so I estimated. "Why the Gulf of Mexico?" I asked. He replied,
"Because command wanted the radiated ones."
I nearly slugged the man right where he stood for agreeing to follow those orders, but I restrained myself. And he went on to tell me that many smaller ships had been dispatched with extraction teams to the radiation zones of destroyed cities to find specimens for study. I agreed in my mind with the intentions, but not the means or storage of these things. Why did they need them from different areas? This man did not know the answer to that, and I was betting the only people who did were on that aircraft carrier. I asked the man how many radiated corpses were on board. He told me that they had acquired 5 of them from the New Orleans hot zone. I asked him how only 5 of those creatures could effectively mission kill the cutter.
He stared off into the night and sat there for a minute, not knowing what to say. I snapped my fingers in front of his face, pulling him out of his trance-like state. He then began telling me what I had feared and suspected.
"These aren't the same as the others, sir. They don't decay like the others. They are stronger, faster, and some say more intelligent. I don't get it. The radiation does something to them, preserves them. The doctors on the carrier think the radiation is some type of catalyst for preserving motor function and regrowing dead cells. Oddly, the regenerated cells are still dead. They don't understand it. No one does. They won't admit it, but I know they made a mistake when they dropped the nukes. The creatures on the ship broke out of their restraining straps and killed the three men guarding them. Those men turned, and it was all we could do to secure the bridge and get the ship moored alongside this oil platform before we were eaten.
He estimated that the ship housed nearly 15 undead now. It was time to act, I supposed. I told the man that I was sorry, and that the carrier would not be acquiring their specimens from this ship. We were going to kill them all. We lost a Marine in the assault. All in all, it took 45 minutes to secure the ship. It was dark, and it would have been suicide for our whole squad to board. I took the gunny and a seasoned staff sergeant with me. He would have had it no other way. I have recently been informed that he had a spouse back at the original Marine base camp. I can say that he fought valiantly and probably saved both the gunny and me. We carefully boarded the ship by jumping over the mooring lines onto the weather deck. Staff Sergeant Mack had the only suppressed weapon in the group. We left the others at home in the event they needed the weapons to defend themselves. I was not familiar with the weapon's handling, so I left it to the Marine. I would have loved to take more than three, but unfortunately, we only had three sets of night vision goggles. Mac wasted the two creatures on the weather deck. Those two were part of the original crew. We piled them on the forecastle and proceeded to secure the ship. Using the ship's 21MC bitch box, we were able to establish communications with six surviving crew members holed up in the galley. I could hear the sound of the undead in the background through the speakers, relentlessly striking the steel roll-down galley shutter. This partition was the only thing keeping the culinary specialists and the ship's senior officer from being eaten. They proceeded to tell us that they had taken down one of the radiated undead with a fire extinguisher and a fire axe. One of the men who had downed the thing was vomiting and weak, probably from exposure. The sailors wore radiation suits inside the New Orleans zone to acquire the specimens, which were no doubt very radioactive and dangerous to be near. The lieutenant told me that the other two were outside the galley partition, pounding on the bulkheads. He seemed to think that much of the undead crew was there with them, but wasn't sure if all of them were present on the other side. We crept through the passageway, down the steep ladders. The galley was in the center of the ship, deep below the waterline. As we approached the main deck, Mac whispered that he was going to destroy one of the bright passageway lights so we could continue to have the upper hand. He shot it out, and this change in atmosphere triggered one of those things to move into the open in front of his weapon. Mac took it out with two shots. The first shot hit the creature's left shoulder and did nothing but spatter black, putrid blood on the wall behind. The second shot hit the creature right on the nose, and I supposed just enough of the brain was scrambled to do the job, as it moved no more. We dragged it to the corner of the passageway and used zip cuffs to bind its arms and legs just to be sure. We kept lurking through the darkness. Every sound was thunder, and every blinking LED seemed like storm lightning. The ship had the familiar smell of mothballs and a tinge of death. We came to a hatch. It was a large steel door used to keep water from flooding adjoining compartments in the event of an attack or emergency. There was a small circle of thick glass no bigger than the diameter of a coffee can on the door where a peephole would be. I looked through and could see the ship's emergency lighting was on. An eerie red glow filled the small room beyond. I cranked the handle on the door, trying to be as quiet as possible, moving a centimeter at a time. We all winced when the hatch creaked from lack of maintenance. I stopped moving the handle and checked the hole again. I saw movement in the compartment beyond. A loud thud rang through our compartment as something very strong hit the hatch. It nearly opened from the pressure, but fortunately I hadn't fully slid the handle to the open position. The creature on the other side obscured the red lighting behind. Its face was pressed against the thick glass, and it was banging its head in a futile attempt to get to us. Every fiber in my body was telling me to leave and not open the thick steel door. We could still turn back and survive. There were men down there, and I knew that every hour they stayed in proximity to the radiated creatures meant they were an hour closer to their death. I told the sergeant that I would slam the latch open, then he would pull the ripcord that I had attached to the door, yanking it open. As there was no use in being quiet about it anymore, I used no care in forcing the handle to the open position. I slammed it home, and Mac yanked the cord. The door flung open, and the creature came through. Luckily for us, the creature was not accustomed to shipboard life and promptly tripped over the knee knocker, landing flat on its face. Expecting this thing to take its time getting up, I readied my weapon for careful aim. I did not get what I expected. This creature was on its feet fast. This was one of the preserved dead from the New Orleans zone. It lurched toward me, and my goggles seemed to crackle like a late-night hometown TV channel that had just finished the national anthem. The last thing I saw was its bony claw reach out before intense light blinded me, and I heard the action of Mac's suppressed H&K. I felt the air move and heard a loud thud as something hit the steel deck. I pulled off my NVGs. As my eyes adjusted to the bright light, I saw Mac's surefire torch lighting up the compartment. Using two mops from a nearby bucket, Mac and I pushed the creature into a corner and tried as best we could to stack heavy objects on top to incapacitate it, like the other creature we had dispatched, again, just in case. We could not zip-cuff the thing, as the radiation was likely at a deadly level. We took no time getting out of this area and through the next. Anywhere this creature had been was probably unsafe. I know it was my imagination, similar to the feeling of your head itching when someone mentions lice, but I could almost feel the heat of radiation on my face and neck. The next compartment was clear. Only one more steel door separated us from the galley area. We were now facing two problems. First, our NVGs were snowing out due to some sort of electromagnetic or radiological interference, and second, the heavy steel door was in fact cracked open slightly. The only real barrier that separated us from the bulk of the undead in the galley was a